radio station where the mighty host of heaven sing.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on. If you want to hear the songs of Zion coming from the land of the endless spring.
Hi, this is Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, and you're listening to 90.1 FM Champaign, WEFT.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500.
40 years of information, opinion, recorded and live music. 40 years of community access. 40 years of living hand to hand. 40 years of freeform radio. We're just warming up. We're aiming for 40 more. Help us with a donation. Go to weft.org and click on the Donate Now button.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview.
This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nyswander, and I am usually doing news at this point in the show, but the news this week is that we have a really important interview with author Barry Smoot, who wrote and recently published the book Failure to Protect. I want to welcome Barry to the program, and we're going to cover a lot of what he discovered in his investigation and his work in Illinois over the years, and then we're going to follow that up next week with an episode talking about possible solutions to the issue. So welcome to the program, Barry.
Hi, Vicki. Glad to be here.
So why don't we start out, Barry, by you introducing yourself to the listeners and letting them know who you are, you know, a little bit about your experience and why you wrote the book.
Well, I began my career in state government as an investigator with DCFS, and then I went from there to the inspector general, and from there as chief of security of a couple state-operated facilities. I had, obviously, from both sides of the fence, experience of seeing what was going on within not only state operated facilities but also private residential programs and day training programs. And what I saw over my entire career was literally nothing was improving, and to the extent of things that could have been improved were ignored. So, you know, I've been working on this book for several years before I retired, and obviously I couldn't release it until after I retired.
Right.
And once I got it compiled, I released it and tried to make it available, you know, for anybody to read.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of this, of your perceptions and experiences with the state of Illinois and services for people with disabilities. What was the first experience that you had to do kind of a double take and said, whoa, this isn't right? What brought you to that place?
Well, it was the availabilities to determine the credibility of an investigation and the low percentages of investigative, what I call definite conclusions. I don't consider a substantiated case, meaning it was proven to be always the good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I consider also an investigative conclusion to show it didn't happen a good thing. But what I was finding is the potential for evidence to utilize to find out if the event actually occurred or not was very limited, which led to what I felt when I started with OIG as being simply a job where you shuffled paper and didn't really make a difference.
Yeah, and I'm sure that doing investigations of that type is a real challenge, simply because you are trying to protect people who are the most vulnerable people in the system, at people who are possibly nonverbal or, you know, don't have any reliable form of communication. How do you investigate in a situation like that?
Well, when they're nonverbal, all you have is physical evidence, which is limited.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking two different burdens of proof here. For for the administrative investigations with the Office of the Inspector General, those were preponderance, which is roughly, people refer to that as 51% evidence. And but with criminal investigations, which is, we'll talk about that, I'm sure, later, there was a higher burden of proof on that. What I always advocated for with OIG for people with developmental challenges is that they should use a lower burden of proof, which is reason to believe. Mm-hmm. Reason to believe is what DCFS uses for children. If the investigator believes the child over the perpetrator, they can substantiate that case. With OIG, they have higher burden of proof, which is preponderance, which means you have to have something else. So when you have somebody who is nonverbal, I mean, absent of somebody admitting they did the abuse, all you have is physical evidence of possibly bruising or other forms of, you know, DNA type evidence. But that is rare. And then a lot of times that evidence is written off as self-injury or accident.
Right.
So you find yourself simply what I call unsubstantiated. Unsubstantiated means there's some evidence that happened, but we don't know if it did.
Yeah, it might be helpful to back up a little bit and explain to people who are listening who aren't familiar with the language of disability in Illinois, what OIG and what role, what OIG is and what role it serves in Illinois.
Yes, the Office of the Inspector General was created, and again, all Office of Inspector Generals, federally, state-wise, were created. They were supposed to be a totally independent entity that could investigate matters internally without fair repercussions or influence. When OIG was created, all they did was investigated state-operated facilities, residential programs. Then as, I'm not sure if it's the appropriate term, but I would say the industry changes, mm-hmm. about the industry of providing proper care to these individuals. Then they had day training programs they investigated. They had community integrated living arrangements, private-owned residential programs.
Mm-hmm.
So it expands with the industry, and so their investigative responsibility expanded.
And they're supposed to be, as you say, they're supposed to be impartial investigators, so they're not going to take the side of the the staff necessarily.
Correct. The staff, the state facility, the private agency, the administration, anybody like that, they're supposed to be totally independent of that.
This has recently been brought to light by some of the accusations made at Shoat Developmental Center down in Anna, Illinois. And, I've lived in Illinois a long time, 35 years or so. And you never, ever hear about people dying. And occasionally you hear about a case of, somebody that was abused in some way or neglected, but you never hear about actual people going to jail because of the things that have been done to folks living in these settings. Why is that coming to light more so now than it has been in the past?
Well, first of all, just to clarify, anything on any active investigations or criminal charges that showed, I can't discuss because I was involved in those investigations. Whether it be a private agency or any state-operated facility, the incidences of criminal prosecution is very low because the obstacle is, according to many prosecutors, which I used to work for prosecutors before I started with the state, is they have to overcome the developmental challenge, especially. They have to convince a jury or a judge that just because this person has a challenge doesn't mean they're not credible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a challenge that a lot of prosecutors don't wish to attempt. It's rare for prosecutions of those matters to occur. So all you would have for a prosecution to occur is another employee witness it and come forth that they saw the abuse, or for the physical evidence to be so overwhelming that there's no way to dispute what occurred.
Yeah. So in one portion of your book, there was a section that talked about investigations, and that the investigation would occur with an individual as long as it was an active investigation unless the person passed away. And if
go ahead.
And if they passed away, they said, okay, we're done. There's nothing we can do to help this person anymore. Therefore, we're going to stop the investigation.
Yes, and that was one part of OIG's expansion. They had Rule 50, which covers the private residential programs, the private day training programs, and the state-operated facilities. What that was about was called Rule 51, the domestic abuse program, which was something that was very well needed. When I first started with OIG, we were always getting calls of somebody who lived on their own or with family that was allegedly abused or neglected, and they had a developmental challenge or physical challenge. And OIG said, sorry, we can't do it. Well, finally, the legislation, they created Rule 51, which gave OIG the authority to do that. And there was a criteria of Rule 51. And, you know, the powers that be at some point, because the caseload was going through the roof, they made the determination that, well, our goal is to provide services, and if the individual has died, we can't provide them services, so we're just going to close the case.
Yeah. Can you even imagine that happening in the world outside of institutional care? That if somebody dies and we say, oh, well, they're dead, so, you know, there's nothing we can do at this point.
Right. Or with DCFS, with children. When a child dies, there's major events that start. The investigation gears up. Mm-hmm. It doesn't shut down. And the only way I became aware of it is, you know, my function at the time was when Rule 51, the domestic abuse program, came out, I was assigned a task to promote it, which the statute required that OIG had to promote it, let people know about this. And so, you know, I was going out and educating everybody, hey, report this stuff. We will take care of it. We can investigate this now. But then the caseload became so high that suddenly I saw a shift. And when I would go out in the public and train either private agency staff or state facility staff, especially private agency staff, I would get up there and talk about this program and how OIG is going to come out and save the day and protect everybody. And it got to a point where people were scoffing or laughing or just simply in training interrupted me and saying, you guys don't do that. And that's how I became aware of the trend of changing to get away from doing these investigations. Because initially, the inspector general at the time, you know, he's like, this is going to be our biggest investigative function because there's far more many people that aren't part of a program than there are that are part of a program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it was trending. That, you know, administrations change and things change. And at some point, somebody made the decision to find ways that we didn't have to investigate those cases.
At the peak of, when did you leave OIG?
2018.
Let me
clarify that. I left because of the exposure that I did about this problem, and I was laid off. I was the only person that I'm familiar with in OIG history that was ever laid off, and I think I was the only person that was laid off in the state of Illinois that year.
Yeah, you weren't alone in this work, though. You had allies, a couple of reporters in Belleville at the newspaper there, and you had a partner that worked with you on uncovering some of this information as well, right?
Yes, there was a, like, I call him a hero of all the heroes in the book. I have several heroes in the book, and Randy Weidler, he was a former domestic abuse program investigator, he was an advocate, as well as the two reporters from the Belleville News Democrat, George Palchak and Beth Hunsdorfer.
Yeah.
And also the spearhead on that was the state representative, Gregory Harris. I referred to him as a hero in this book also.
Yeah. We talked about maybe inviting some of those folks to talk next week with us, and we'll certainly work on that. But I did want you to talk a little bit about the fact that in your book, you do say that not everybody who works at a state-operated developmental center is an abusive caretaker. There are good people who work there, right?
There are very good people that work there, and outstanding people who work in state-operated facilities and private agency residential programs. And even my grandfather retired at a state-operated facility as a technician. So yes, I mean, when I used to train, I always used to say, when I'm talking about bad case scenarios of abuse, I always used to say 1%. I had nothing to back that up, and I still have nothing to back that up. I always say 99% of the staff are fantastic, provide exceptional care that I may not even be able to provide. But it's always the 1% that cause the problems and create the risk.
Yeah,
so by all means, no. Majority of the staff bad? No, not even close. Is it a majority?
But there is a culture there of people protecting each other, is there not?
Yes, and that's instilled. I'm basing this on what I've been told, what I've seen. A lot of times your good staff are not what we used to call the alpha aggressive staff.
Mm-hmm.
The good staff are the more compassionate ones who provide care and safety. The ones who do the bad things are more the alpha aggressive staff that commit the abuse, and then they intimidate the good staff, you know, and say things along the lines of, well, you know, if you tell on us, you may find yourself alone sometime. You know, threats, intimidation in the appearance. Not like physical contact, but just more implications of you better not tell.
Yeah, and I think that intimidation was evident as well for people with disabilities who had been abused somehow, who I think at one point in your book you said that oftentimes people were asked questions in the presence of their accused abuser.
Yes, which violates any investigative principle that was ever created. The problem is, at the time with OIG, I can't say now because I've been gone for a while, but a lot of times there was a lot of people hired that really didn't have the investigative background or the investigative training. But anybody of any training knows you never interview a potential victim in the presence of the alleged accused.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of the things that you learned about, that you investigated, that were some of the most disturbing things that you learned?
Well, again, now they weren't things always that I investigated. I would become, you know, OIG, we would share different cases and stuff.
Sure, that's fair.
After I was an investigator, I became a trainer, so I would train private agency staff and state facility staff how to do investigations, as well as OIG staff how to do investigations, along with another trainer from OIG who covered the northern part of the state. So we became aware of these different case synopsises so we could discuss them and use them as an educational training tool for all staff who were conducting investigations. But, you know, I mean, there's been everything, you know, from sexual assault to murders to physical abuse to neglect. But there was a case one time that it just really pulled at my heart because I saw the video. And they had a video at this private agency. It was at Estilla. And the individual, later we saw the documents, and the documents said he had rug burns on his buttocks and legs, but he was nonverbal, so nobody knew how it happened. Well, the director at this private agency, he had the presence of mind. He had cameras at his villas. And so when he saw these suspicious rug burns, he went back and started looking. And when he saw this, he reported to OIG, thankfully. And what I saw in this video, like I said, it wasn't, I don't want to sound cold-hearted, but in the things I've seen in my career, it wasn't the worst abuse, but in a lot of your listeners, it's going to be horrendous abuse. But again, I've seen some really bad things that could give you nightmares. But in this case, this little individual, and I'm not meaning that derogatory, saying little, he was tiny. He was probably 75 pounds, and he liked to play with his rubber ball. And you see on the video, the employee was sitting on a couch watching TV. The individual came out with his ball and he wanted to play. So he bounced the ball to the staff. The staff bounced it back. Now this employee at the Stilla was by himself, which is allowed. He was the only employee working that night. And this happened a couple times. He'd hit the ball away, the individual would get it and bring it back. Well, I guess it was interrupting the employee. So next thing he saw, he walks toward the individual and the individual falls to the ground because he knew what was going to happen, apparently. Even though he was nonverbal, the employee grabs him by the ankle. The individual is in his underwear and a t-shirt, and he drags him approximately 15 feet across carpet. And I can't describe it any more than threw him back in his bedroom, shut the door. That's how he got the rug burns. Yeah. Had it not been for cameras, nobody would have ever known.
Yeah, and I know you're a big advocate of cameras. Do you think that's going to solve everything, though?
Well, not everything, but I'm a big advocate of psychological testing online. It's become so affordable nowadays, like with law enforcement and firefighters, they can take an online assessment and it will identify issues. Mm-hmm. It's not an expensive item, but you know, psychological profiling, cameras. I you know, in my book, I also reference something that may make a lot of, I don't know, politicians cringe. Mm-hmm. But I think that staff that provide direct care, only direct care staff, whether it be private agency or state facility, I think they ought to get a tax break because they provide such a great service. And a lot of times they will leave these jobs to go somewhere where they get a little bit better benefits or a little bit better pay. Mm-hmm. But if they got a state tax break because they were direct care providers, it may keep the good staff on board to provide this care.
You know, I have a daughter with a disability who would, you know, ultimately qualify, I suppose, to go to a state-operated developmental center if we chose to make that move for her. She's certainly not, beyond the realm of possibility for her, given that she has Down syndrome, and many residents of state ops do have that disability as well as many others. I've always been really concerned about people who are in those positions of being a caretaker at a SILA or at a state op or, you know, anywhere in a day program and having that responsibility, but also having access to people who are so vulnerable. And how do you, as a parent, know that your child is safe and cared for in an appropriate way?
Well, you know, sadly, there's no guarantee. But in my experience, you know, better screening, better pay. And I'm not saying it's a fix-all. I'm going to be clear. You know, I know you referenced that I thought cameras were a fix-all. But I'm saying it'll be a total culture change mm-hmm. at any location once those cameras are involved. Because it will quickly identify perpetrators, and it will also be a deterrent to the abuse. And I've seen it over and over how cameras are a benefit. Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked to, you know, staff that own private agencies right from different spectrums. I've had some that say, yeah, we're going to put cameras, we're going to use it as a marketing tool to say, look, we're going to provide everything possible to make the parents and guardians feel comfortable that their family are safe. And I've also heard some say, we don't want cameras because we really don't want to know what our staff are doing.
Yeah, and also, you know, for families who do have a relationship with their family member who is in a SILA or a state-operated developmental center, who, you know, maybe the person comes home for a weekend and they suspect that there has been, you know, they have see bruises on their family member, or you know, they're just acting different than they have in the past. What is the process if they suspect that there is something going on that's not a good thing at their residential setting?
Well, the first thing is to remember to report it to OIG, and if they don't get the response they get from the intake worker, they need to ask for a supervisor. Because I don't think I've revealed this to you. My book did, but I had a cousin who was, you know, profoundly developmentally challenged. Mm-hmm. His guardian, he has since passed, but my guardian, or his guardian contacted me once and said, hey, when we bring him home on visits, he's got all these bruises all over his stomach. Now me, from my investigative training, I know that's a red flag. Mm-hmm. Because how often do you get a bruise on your stomach if somebody didn't hit you? I guess you could have fallen on the corner of a table or something, but a majority of the time, a bruise to the stomach is as suspicious as a black eye. And but he was nonverbal. So I said, well, you know, report it to OIG, which he did. But they couldn't come to a conclusion, because how could they come to a conclusion? If another employee didn't say they saw it happen, that's all they had.
Yeah.
And they never were able to reveal how he continually had bruising to his stomach.
Talking about cameras, you know, we had this conversation before the interview today, but when you talk about cameras, there are automatically concerns about privacy. for individuals. Mm-hmm. Address that a little bit.
Okay, well, first of all, like my opinion is, does privacy outweigh being physically abused and sexually assaulted? Mm-hmm. That's the first question. Would you rather your family member have privacy, or would you rather them not be physically abused and sexually assaulted?
Right.
That's the first question. The privacy issue, a lot of people have misconceptions about the cameras. First of all, they are in general areas, hallways, kitchens, living rooms. They're not in bathrooms. They're not in bedrooms. You don't need that. If you have a camera shooting down a hallway and you see an employee go into a bedroom at 3 in the morning and stay in there for 30 minutes, and then an individual has suspicious bruising to their pelvic area or something, or somebody has another red flag, that camera can help support whether or not sexual assault had occurred, mm-hmm. or physical abuse had occurred. The other thing is, they think like you can go online and everybody in the world can view this camera of the stilla or the state operated facility. That's incorrect. At any stilla or any facility, OIG, when they establish the criteria for these, there has to be no more than probably 2 people that have access to that video, because that it's treated as evidence. So you can't have, you know, 25 people that have access to the camera, because then what would happen? If something did happen, they could delete that video.
Mm-hmm.
So you have authorized staff that only have access to that video. Something interesting that was pointed out to me by one of what I call one of the good stillas, they told me, the administrator told me, she goes, we put cameras in not only for safety of abuse and neglect, but she said, we used to worry that our staff were sleeping. But the problem now is the staff leave and then they come back at the end of their shift. She goes, now I can pull that camera up and make sure that the staff that are assigned to be there are actually there.
Hmm.
So that's a big benefit. You know, I mean, because in situations like that, at a stilla or at a state facility, if staff leave and nobody knows they've left, that usually only gets revealed when there's a tragic event, such as a fire.
Yeah.
Then you know, a lot of people perish, and then everybody will realize no one was there to help them.
Yeah. Another question we talked about offline last week was the idea that OIG would respond if there was abuse of one client or one person with a disability as a resident abusing another person with a disability. And I, not to go into my personal situation, but I had an experience where I contacted OIG for that very type of reason and was told that they did not investigate those kinds of abuses.
Well, I believe I conveyed to you that they were incorrect.
Yeah.
Because OIG, it always has to be an employee as the accused and an individual as the victim. However, if it's an individual to individual physical or sexual assault,
mm-hmm.
the question comes into play is, how did that occur? Where were staff? So if it occurred and staff should have intervened and didn't, then OIG would investigate that as a neglect against staff for not stopping the physical or sexual abuse against from individual to individual.
Okay.
So they could have taken that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely so. So I'd be really interested in continuing this conversation next week, Barry. Your book is really interesting. As I said, I have a dog-eared copy because I read it and marked many pages in it. The book is called Failure to Protect by Barry G. Smoot. You can get it on Amazon. And come back next week and hear the rest of the story, because we're going to continue this discussion next Monday. Thank you so much for joining me today, Barry.
Thanks for having me. Have a good evening.
You too. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your week. No, I'm staying.